if my words did glow with the cold of sunshine, and my tunes were played on the harp unstrung. Would you hear my voice come through the music? Would you hold it near as it were your own? It's a hand-me-down.
Hello there, ladies and gentlemen. This is Tim Benall with BenallofAmerica.com's one and only audio series, Benall of America Audio, Season 1. Welcome back. This is the October 29th edition. Little in-house notes before we kick it off. Thank you out there to everybody who's trying out the new streaming audio at BenallofAmerica.com. You can listen to the audio here and not have to download the MP3s. You can listen to it streaming, listen to it at work. If you get the dial-up, you can check it out now. Hopefully this will open up a wide new avenue of listening options for the BenallofAmerica.com, Benall of America Audio listeners. And thanks out there to all the great websites that have been promoting Benall of America Audio and helping us out and get the word out here. This week we have Peter Robbins. Here's a little bit about Peter Robbins for you who are unfamiliar with him. He's been involved in UFO studies for more than 25 years as a researcher, investigator, writer, lecturer, activist, and author. He's a board member of the Bud Hopkins Intruders Foundation and is co-author of the British bestseller Left at East Gate, a first-hand account of the Bentwaters Woodbridge UFO incident, its cover-up and investigation. He's a current contributor to Phenomena Magazine, UFO Magazine, UFO Report, Japan, Fate Magazine, and a host of other publications and websites. Peter has lectured extensively both in the United States and abroad, including dozens of talks throughout the United Kingdom. Venues have included local, national, and international conferences, as well as presentations for organizations, seminars, private groups, public, private, and secondary schools, universities, libraries, scientific organizations, educational foundations, and Cambridge Hospital in Boston under the sponsorship of the late Pulitzer Prize winner Dr. John Mack. His lecture topics have included, but not been limited to, the UK's RAF Bentwaters Woodbridge UFO incident, the suppression of UFO information by the American and British governments, James Forrestal, first Secretary of Defense and early casualty of UFO secrecy, the emergence of the national security state, Dr. Wilhelm Reich and UFOs, the UFO abduction phenomenon, the crop circle phenomenon, and the media and UFOs. So as you can see, Peter is well-versed in a host of UFO-related topics. He's been in the field for a very long time. So I was totally psyched when we got the opportunity to speak with him and bring him to the BenallofAmerica.com visitors and the Benall of America audio listeners. What's key here also is that we are quickly approaching the 25th anniversary of the RAF Bentwaters Woodbridge incident. You're going to be hearing a lot more about the RAF Bentwaters incident. He's sent along post-interview some dates to note, and that is that the updated edition of Left at East Gate will be available around December 1st. And on December 17th, the History Channel will be premiering a brand new documentary that both he and Larry Warren were consultants on. Also, he notes that the Sci-Fi Channel will be rebroadcasting the documentary UFO Invasion at Rendlesham on December 1st at 1 p.m. Eastern, and hopefully it will be running it several more times throughout the month as we get closer to the anniversary of the Rendlesham Forest incident that last week in December. Without any further ado, let's rock and roll. This interview was conducted on September 5th, 2005. Peter Robbins, Part 1 of 2 on Benall of America Audio, Season 1.
All right. Well, we'll just get going then.
Yep. Hit me with your best shot.
Okay. All right. Well, first of all, let me just give a little introduction to Peter Robbins here. There's more information on the website, I'm sure. He's the author of Left at East Gate. That's probably what he's most famous for. It's a fantastic book. I just finished it this past week. I really loved it. It's almost like a story within a story. It's the story of Larry Warren's amazing UFO experience while he was stationed in England. And then it sort of turns into the story of the writing of the book.
Yeah.
And the characters that come along and the amazing saga of trying to get this story of Larry's experience from the forest of Rendlesham all the way to the bookstores of your average person.
Mm.
So I think that was really it's human drama at its finest. I think anyone who follows the ufology field will be interested in seeing what really goes on in that sort of environment where someone has a story to tell and the saga it takes to try and get it out there and all the people that put walls up and trying to find the various witnesses and all the things that go along with it. So, I'm here with Peter Robbins, and also I wanted to mention that Peter Robbins was one of the nicest people I ever met at the X Conference 2004. I was really just a newcomer to the UFO field, sort of a fanboy, but of all the people I met, Peter Robbins was like the nicest and just took me under his wing and hung out with me all Sunday night on the last night there. And that was really cool, and I'll always appreciate that. So, Peter Robinson, he's of all the people I talk to in ufology, everyone says great things about Peter Robinson. When I just mention him casually, they're like, oh, Peter Robinson, I love that guy. So you're very well spoken of. And here's Peter Robinson. Thank you so much for the chance to speak with you about this great book and all your other awesome work.
Well, Tim, it's a pleasure, and thank you for your kind thoughts and very perceptive kind of analysis of the book. It really is a story within a story, and you know, although we're all obviously one of the things we have in common is a tremendous curiosity about these other intelligences, whatever they may be, as you now know from reading the book, we discuss in as much depth as we can Larry's experience, what we make of it. But to the frustration of some readers, the book is really not about, you know, aliens and flying saucers. It's a book about human beings, often under stress, and other human beings who are applying the stress. Essentially, it's a book about what people in positions of power in intelligence and military are willing to do, or the lengths they're willing to go to apply pressure so that our government, our intelligence service, our military, are not embarrassed because of these highly classified things.
All right, so before you even got involved with the book, why don't you give me a little bit of background on, because you were in the ufology field for a while before Larry approached you to write the book, so like before you got into the book, like let's save how you actually got into the book for later when we get into that, but your background before this whole thing happened with you.
Well, my background is primarily in the arts. I had always wanted to be a painter. It's what I studied in university and then transferred to and graduated from the School of Arts in New York City. I taught painting there for quite a number of years, also taught at a number of private schools and other institutions. In an ironic way, that took me into the world of the theater, where I still work part-time in theatrical management in New York City, as well as working with a man I consider one of the finest directors and the finest acting coach I've ever worked with. That's an old friend of mine named John Strasberg, the last name of which may be somewhat familiar to some of your listeners, because John Stad was Lee Strasberg, arguably the most important acting coach of the 20th century. My interest in UFOs springs from about, well, the mid-70s. I got into it with something of a vengeance and a certain amount of resentment. I'm proud of the work I've done in the field. I'm very proud of the book that you've just finished and my continuing contributions, but I've never been able to say I love it. I love theater. I love the arts. Flat out, this is an obsession and something I do because I think it's important. Maybe something that I can do a little better than some of my other colleagues is present some of this material, which granted sounds extremely loopy to the uninitiated or far out or kind of goofy, in a way where it can be taken more seriously. I consider myself a very analytical person. I'm certainly spiritual, but I'm not mystical. I had the great good fortune getting into the field to have three extremely different and distinct mentors. The best known, of course, is Bud Hopkins, who is a name that will be familiar to quite a number of your listeners. Bud is certainly, well, he's the best known figure in ufology since the death of Alan Hynek. And the father of the entire field of the abduction phenomena. He's also a very fine painter, and we connected up early on in both of our interests in the subject. In fact, I'm always proud to say we both did our very first UFO presentations together, believe it or not, at the School of Visual Arts when I was a faculty member there. But before Bud, my first real mentor in the field was a gentleman who I kind of thought of as my ufological grandfather, Komen von Kavetsky. When I met him, was already in his 70s, and well, Komen had been a staff officer in the Royal Hungarian Army during World War II, in charge of photo education and photo analysis for the Hungarian military. So he had a very pragmatic eye, and when he emigrated to the States in the early 50s, he arrived literally within months of the now famous UFO sightings over the Capitol in 1951 or 52, as I recall, and got right into the work from there. He had worked as a consultant for some years to the Attorney General of the United Nations, and when I met him, he took me under his wing in the mid-70s, later 70s. My first real job of any significance in the UFO field was working as a research assistant and editor on a paper that was presented at the United Nations at their open UFO hearings in November of 1978. My last mentor, and in some ways the most impacting one in terms of the way that I investigate things, was a guy named Pete Mazzola. Pete was a bigger-than-life New York City police officer. He was actually a detective sergeant in the New York City Police Department. A tough, no-nonsense guy, heart of gold, but a guy out of a Kojak episode. He was really all cop and an ace UFO investigator. He had had a profound UFO sighting while serving in combat in Vietnam, one of the best introductory stories I had ever heard, and somebody who didn't spin anything. And he, when he got into the field, you know, he was a police investigator, and that's how he investigated UFO studies until his death. And I like to think I'm following in his suit as far as investigative techniques. So that was pretty much in the 70s. I started to, well, basically do what a lot of us do, and, you know, you're certainly a good example. Once your interest is captured, you begin to read, you try to sort out the wheat from the chaff, you try to seek out more grounded and well-informed and rational people, or so we do our best to perceive, rather than, you know, goofballs and mystics and semi-lunatics or true believers as opposed to folks that take nothing at face value, don't jump to conclusions, and continued to work, ultimately started to, you know, write my own articles, began to submit them to various publications, began to get them published. I've never been a shrinking violet in front of a crowd. I always think it's kind of ironic that when you read studies of fears of average Americans, the fear of public speaking is usually right next to the fear of death, really. And I'm a bit of a ham, but I use my time in the public eye as responsibly as I can. And so it was a pretty natural thing for me to take my writing and move into the realm of presentations and conferences and really wherever I could get speaking dates. And I still am open to almost any venues, from small organizations, libraries, non-UFO related groups that feel they might be interested in the subject, to, of course, MUFON and BUFORA and so many of the wonderful grassroots organizations in this country and really around the world. And frankly, I was about 12 years into the field when Larry and I really connected and this project started to actualize.
All right. Wow. That's a lot of stuff. I feel like I know you so much better now. Wow. Well, let's just jump right to the book before I'll wait until some time when I see you. I'll pick your brain about all this back
sure.
stuff. for the people who don't know really the story of the Bentwaters incident, let's give them a thumbnail sketch of what happened. First, let me try and present it. A bare bones version.
Very good.
Flesh it out a little bit.
Uh-huh.
All right, this is the Bentwaters Air Force Base, American Air Base, in Britain. And sometime after Christmas, 81?
80.
Okay. Mm-hmm. There was a UFO incident on one night. Then there was another one on the second night, a slight escalation. I'm a little vague on the second night.
Uh-huh.
And then on the third night was the big night.
Yeah.
When the UFO landed, we think, you know, before this is the incident.
Yeah.
And Larry Warren, who is your co-author, was among the security troops who were sent there.
Yes.
And at that point, Larry got pretty close to the craft, and it landed. And there was quite a few people there. It seemed it was very chaotic. The trying to get a grasp on the situation that was going on there, reading it was. You really want to like put yourself there. It sounds very chaotic. And then someone in the higher command stepped forward, and there was some sort of communication between him and the craft or the beings. I wasn't sure if they were in the craft or that was, you know. And then I think Larry Warren blacked out there, I'm pretty sure, or something happened after that. Then Larry had this whole other adventure that went on after that. But that's pretty much the incident in Bentwaters was a UFO landing as a culmination of three nights. Mm. I probably did too vague of a description of it, but that's...
It's a good bare bones.
trying to recall it all, and you really have to... I would really love to check it out someday because you kind of have to see the scene of the incident to really get it. And it's in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And, oh, it just sounds terrifying.
I imagine it was, and I'll backtrack a bit and bring us into it with a little more detail.
Thanks.
No, you did fine. Larry joined the Air Force, I think for all the right reasons, all the old-fashioned reasons that young men have gone into the service for several thousand years, see the world, wear a uniform, carry a weapon, meet women in other countries, you know, for him, he was a big rock and roll fan, very knowledgeable about popular music, has worked in the field on and off for years in promotion and publicity positions, has a tremendous circle of friends who are remarkably well-known popular musicians. But at the time, coming out of high school, like so many in the late 70s, big fan of the English bands, certainly the Beatles, The Who, and you know, the things that inform important decisions in life can seem a bit flighty on the surface. Larry liked the idea of going to England. He had done a high school year there. He was quite in love with many things about the country. Ultimately, you know, it was a chance to see a lot of these bands live and, all right, you know, asked to be assigned to England, and he was. Did his basic training in Lackland in Texas. And that's where the story sort of jumps off the standard, besides all the normal training. And his training was focused on two specialty areas. One was anti-terrorism, and although this was the late 70s and well before the gleam in Al-Qaeda's eye, Irish terrorism was more a reality there than not. It was the height of the Cold War as well. He was also specifically trained to work around nuclear ordnance. That understood, the training veered off for him and a number of other men when they were brought through a specific series of other tests and procedures, which, looking back on it, are very non-standard. Asked if they had ever had a UFO experience, paranormal experiences, and Larry had. Ultimately, in December of 1980, the beginning of December, he is assigned to a flight, a shift, as a security police officer on the Bentwaters base, and completed his training on the job. For the record, just to sort of locate this in terms of popular culture history, I think he went on shift on December 2nd, and December 8th, sadly, was the day that John Lennon was shot to death in New York. That following weekend, he and many of his base colleagues went to London for a huge memorial, and then went back and continued on their jobs. The Bentwaters incident also, to avoid any confusion, it's referred to as the Bentwaters incident, the Bentwaters Woodbridge UFO incident, and in England better known as the Rendlesham Forest incident, because that particular forest abuts two highly secured and very important NATO bases in the United Kingdom at the time, RAF Bentwaters, at least to the Americans, and RAF Woodbridge, about 6 miles away with a good-sized American contingent on it. The incident, the Bentwaters incident itself, is actually, as Tim has just said, more or less a series of events that took place on three consecutive nights between Christmas and New Year's. Some of the high points are on the very first night, unknowns, lights in the night sky that were giving radar readings that were certainly visible from the ground by troops and local folks, were seen coming in over this twin base area. And a number of them came in over the weapons storage area. And that's euphemism essentially for the nuclear weapons storage area. To just give a bit of historical accuracy here, we had something like 350,000 kilograms, kilotons, what am I saying, 350,000 kilotons of nuclear ordnance housed underneath this twin base complex. 2 years before, our treaty with the United Kingdom allowed us to have nuclear ordnance in the United Kingdom. So we not only have a major treaty violation as part of the backstory here, but a potentially very disastrous one. Also, that week, late December 1980, if you go to any major newspaper and go to the international section, the big story was this potential uprising. A pro-democracy movement had taken hold in Poland's Gdansk shipyard under essentially the leadership of a remarkably dynamic and inspired man who was an electrician named Lech Walesa, who absolutely radicalized a good part of the Polish population to the possibilities of a democratic Poland. So there was a great deal of tension in Poland at the time. What you and I and our parents and anybody else reading the paper was not aware of in late December 1980, because it was classified, is that the Soviets had massed over 100,000 crack troops right on their southern border with Poland, and had this pro-democracy event gotten out of the Soviets' control, they were prepared to roll into Poland and restore order. NATO, being fully aware of this, had put every single NATO base in the United Kingdom and Europe on a full red alert. Red is one step below black, and black is war. Had they rolled, we would have possibly seen the beginning of World War III. Almost all of the fighter aircraft on Bentwaters were no longer there. They were already in West Germany, what we call forward operating locations, waiting for orders to potentially fly against the Soviet Union. So with this nuclear cover-up going on, as well as the fact that there was a potentially disastrous international situation hanging overhead, there was already plenty of tension when these unknowns came in over this very strategic pair of NATO bases. Two major events defined the first night. One was the fact that some of these craft, because I don't know what else to call them, they were real machines, apparently metallic and certainly under intelligent control, shot down beams of light into the weapons storage area. And somehow, I couldn't begin to explain the physics because I have no idea how it works. It's not my area. So these beams of light, which this was before you had little handheld laser pointers by quite some years. And being England, a fairly healthy moisture content in the air, you know, billions of little water droplets, you could actually see these lines of light going from these things down to the ground. Somehow, they penetrated these hardened bunkers, alternating layers of earth, concrete, and steel, and made their way down, these beams of light, to the nuclear ordnance. And in the very chilling words of the then deputy base commander, who told myself and Larry in a rather charged meeting that I had waited years for, in a shopping mall directly across the street from the Pentagon, and you've read the transcript of that conversation now, that somehow these beams of light, what was his wonderful phrase in militaries, adversely affected the ordnance, which is very chilling when you're talking about 350,000 kilotons of nuclear weaponry.
Yeah.
Obviously, they didn't affect it adversely in detonation, but they seemed to screw up the mechanisms. More than that, I don't know, but I heard that directly from the former deputy base commander. That is one series of events on the first night. The other was the sister base about 6 miles away. Some of the law enforcement cops in the Air Force, you have two types of police officers. You've got the security cops, who are the equivalent of paramilitary, and the LEs, law enforcement guys, who are more the equivalent of, you know, your boys in blue. They observed a light going down in the woods, and although there was no impact, no fire, no explosion, they were prudent and reported it as though it might be a downed plane, and requested from the East Gate, where they had observed it, of Woodbridge permission to go in and investigate, and four security cops did just that. They headed off into the woods, and ultimately what they encountered there was something from a Spielberg movie or a Twilight Zone episode. It was a triangular machine, approximately equilateral triangle, approximately 7 feet on a side, about 3 meters. It was black, extremely glossy, almost like black glass. It was moving, more or less meandering through the woods, you know, maneuvering around trees, nice as you please, at about chest height. And the men came upon it and were quite shocked. They got close enough to be able to actually see writing, not decipherable, hieroglyphic symbolism on the machine. One of the men, to my best information, and that in this case is from one of the other witnesses, drew a weapon on it. He drew his sidearm and then impulsively jumped on it, and it went 10 meters or so before he let go. That was John Burroughs. One of the men went missing that night, and he was gone for some time. Another of the men, Jim Peniston, tried to record it as quickly as he could, drawing, you know, some pictures in his notebook as he stood there. Jim was a very important part of a recent, about 2 years now, a good documentary on the subject made by the Sci-Fi Channel, which is still in rotation and I'm sure will be reshown in December, which will be the 25th anniversary of the incident. And the men have very incomplete memories of the evening. There is a possibility of abduction, but it was hours before they came out of the woods with incomplete memories and very, very shaken up. So that was part of the first night. The second night, there were a number of overflights, again over the Twin Base complex in the wet Rendlesham Forest. Things as small as dots of light that moved erratically, other things that were quite articulated disks. And a number of them came down around the Twin Bases. And I mean that actually, they came down through the trees, in some cases tearing out branch and leaf forest cover, rudely sort of bumping up against trees and ripping out parts of bark. Several of them settled into the surrounding countryside, And the one that's best known, the one that Colonel Halt and his men documented later, had left three circular impressions in the soil. They were equilateral. Pressure tests later done suggest that whatever sat there may well have weighed several tons, or if it was a fabrication, somebody was able to mimic that. The impressions in the soil, which I stress were absolutely circular, as well as where tree bark had been ripped or forest canopy had been removed, upon measurement, registered beta and gamma background radiation counts in excess of 10 times the norm in the area. Colonel Halt, the deputy base commander, who was very skeptical about the first night's sightings, was informed of this at a party. And let's remember again, this is right between Christmas and New Year's. A lot of the officers were attending parties in this period of time. He was told by whoever it was that reported it to him, I forget, that they were back. And he went back to his residence first and changed into more appropriate field clothing, put his microcassette recorder in his pocket, and took a small team tent out and investigate. His intention, as he made very clear to Larry and I when we did meet, and he's been on record about since, was not to document this, but to expose it as nonsense. And that is how he felt until they started coming in directly over them. There is now, in ufology, a very famous tape recording. It runs 16 or 17 minutes. And it is a segment, from what I understand through Mr. Hall, is a full tape that runs several hours that nobody I know except for him has ever heard. But there is no question in our minds that this is a fully authentic recording of American military personnel under tremendous stress, as in one case, one of these things is coming through the woods very much toward them, with a pulsating light on it, and you hear the absolute tension in the voices. This is not, you know, a bunch of guys goofing around. It's anything but. But they took plaster castings of those impressions, made their measurements, reported in. And second night also, some of the lights in the night sky were moving in a very, very regulated way, mimicking what one person said was like a grid search. Had a plane gone down and you had, you know, choppers in the sky going back and forth looking in a programmed way for a crash scene. Anyway, over these first two nights, my co-author was on leave in Germany. Met a girl in Germany, gone back to Germany. Reported back the third morning. The base was on a full alert. There is a photograph that we have in the book of the main base entrance with a sign that says alert. That was the status. When you are in a position where you're going to be put on a guard duty at an American military base, I'm sure other militaries as well, you are checked out beforehand. And especially in light of the fact that certain debunkers and naysayers have had the gall to suggest that some of these men were blowing weed in the woods and, you know, kind of stoned and, you know, that's what happened. Everybody was carrying a fully loaded automatic weapon. These men were checked out, and if they had had a beer that morning, if they had taken a cold pill, they were excused from duty. You had to be straight as an arrow, and they all were. Again, bearing in mind that we didn't know whether or not we'd be going to war within 24 hours with the Russians. Every single outpost on the Bentwaters perimeter, I don't know about Woodbridge, I'm imagining it was much the same, was manned. And Larry had been posted to probably the most remote part of the perimeter, a small posting called Perimeter Post 18, also a photo of that in the book. And this is already fairly late at night. He has his M16, he has a Motorola radio, and he's by himself. He has not heard anything about the previous two nights. Some have suggested You know, there were rumors sweeping the base. Men were told to be quiet about it, and they were. But that evening, he heard men further down the line, several miles down, making, you know, nervous observations and silly jokes about the lights they were seeing in the night sky. The lights were fairly close to the horizon, so Larry was not able to see them from where he was. But the chatter that he was hearing on the Motorola was interrupted by a more senior personnel who told him to pipe down and get off the frequency. This is not a joking matter. And shortly after this, he and other men, certainly he, was radioed and told to close down his posting, that he would be picked up shortly by military vehicle and brought on to another assignment. Soon after, an American Air Force vehicle, a pickup truck, driven by Lieutenant Bruce England, containing a number of men, including Sergeant Adrian Bastinza, who ultimately would stand next to him during the event, were picked up at their postings, and they and other vehicles converged at the base motor pool. As I recall, it's now probably close to midnight or after. And there's an unusual amount of activity at the motor pool. Many vehicles are having what we call light alls hooked up to them, which are kind of the civilian equivalent of what we think of as big Hollywood premiere lights. These ones are gas-operated. The tanks were all topped off. The generators were checked. And the vehicles then came into a cordon, came into line together at the base entrance, and then on a command rolled out into the English countryside. Now, by comparison to the nuclear ordnance problem, this would be considered a minor treaty violation, but in fact it was not minor. All of these men were fully armed with loaded automatic weapons, and that's all right when you're on base. All of a sudden you are in your host country and private land, and that is not all right. However, this caravan headed off down the road and ultimately went past RAF Woodbridge, 5-6 miles away, where they were stopped by a military policeman in the road. And in front of Larry's vehicle was a small civilian Ford Cortina. It was white, and it had a woman and, I believe, a sleeping child in it. They were close enough to hear the military person telling the woman that they were having to hold them up for a bit because they had found some unexploded ordnance and were having to remove it before allowing traffic through. Now, that might sound like a load of nonsense. In most places, it's rather extraordinary claim. But you have to remember, this is the exact location over which the Battle of Britain was fought in 1940. And now, 65 years later, they're still occasionally pulling unexploded ordnance out of the forest or, you know, yeah. Anyway, after a while, they were told to continue, and the civilian did. The military cop told our guys to go past the East Gate entrance of RAF Woodbridge and then make their left after the East Gate Road onto a logging road and go up that road, which they did, quarter, half a mile. The vehicles pulled into a rather cleared circular area. This is in the forest. And one by one, the vehicles pulled up. The men disembarked. And then an armorer's vehicle, which really was not much more than another pickup truck with racks welded on the back, pulled up. Then the weapons were collected. The men were broken into three-man groups. Each group got a Motorola radio, and the men were told to head off in that direction and investigate a disturbance, which they did. The first sign that something was very non-standard happened as they headed through the woods and experienced a tremendous static electricity charge in the air. We're most familiar with it as kids from, you know, rubbing a balloon on your sleeve and then it'll stick to you, that kind of thing. Yeah. And it'll raise the hair on your arm. Let's remember here that most of these guys, although they were very highly trained military personnel, were young guys. They were 18, 19, 20 years old, and accordingly, most of them had good thick heads of hair. This was a group that did not wear helmets. They wore berets, as you remember. And the static electricity charge in the air was so ferocious that it was pushing the berets off their heads, which is extremely memorable thing. Facts, allegations like that stick in my mind more than often very outlandish claims. Larry, as they continued on, heard a man crying, and they came upon a fellow security cop who had broken down and was sobbing, and kind of curled up with his back to a stump, being comforted and calmed by another personnel. They continued into the woods and saw a glow in the distance, and ultimately that glow revealed itself to be in a farmer's field, which is called Capel Green. It's a private farmer's field. You'll find it on any English survey map of that area. And as they got to the point where the forest stopped and the field began, they could see 50, 60 feet out in the field, a illuminated ground fog. Now, any of us that have ever watched a nice old Sherlock Holmes movie know, you know, fogs are a nice romantic aspect of England. This was not a normal ground fog. It was perfectly circular, 40 or 50 feet across, as I recall. It was self-illuminated like a giant aspirin tablet on the ground, and I mean self-illuminated. They were bringing these lightalls out to the field, but none of them would work. In the meantime, the Motorola radios were fritzing out. The flashlights were refusing to operate practically. There was a problem. There was no moon that night. They were far enough away from the base that there was literally no ambient light. The only light was at the far end of the field, the little farmer's house, and the lights were on the second floor there, but certainly nothing that could illuminate this ground fog. The men were then ordered to surround this ground fog. Non-standard, but, you know, it was the order. Anyway, after a while of just standing their positions, again, everybody is now disarmed, they observed coming in really slowly a reddish light coming in from the direction of the North Sea. And at this point, we're only 5 or 6 miles from the coast. And they watched it as it came in directly over the field and then directly over the ground fog and then, as has been best described to me, exploded without a sound in a flash of light that was so blinding that it was described as magnesium-like. So much so that I can tell you for a fact, and this is not from copies, this is from some of the few original Air Force records of Larry's that we have, that the flash of light was so ferocious that it burned the retinas of my co-author's eyes. I would deduce that other men were so affected, but I don't have their medical records, so I cannot absolutely state that. And, you know, as we remember from the old flashbulb days, if you ever, you know, got a close-up flash picture, it can take a couple of seconds for your eyes to readjust to the dark. And when their eyes did, sitting in this ground fog on some kind of metal structure, landing apparatus, or whatever you want to call it, was now a machine of wholly undetermined origin. At this point, a number of men simply ran off, and I might well have been among them. The fact is that most of them held their mark. It is a military situation, and they are well trained. And they held their mark. Larry and Adrian Bastinza, sergeant, who was right next to him, were within 15 to 20 feet of this thing. It was self-illuminated, and the surface was playing tricks with their sense of vision. I've had it described to me as sort of shifting mother of pearl, that you could see clearer if you sort of tilted your head and looked peripherally at it rather than right at it. And just to add to the madness, it was playing games with the shadows of the men that surrounded it. Larry observed that if you moved, your shadow moved on the surface of the craft, but a second, 2 seconds or so afterwards. which of course is impossible, but what's just as impossible or more impossible is the fact that there were no lights behind them. So none of this made real sense. I think it's also fair to say that there's a certain amount of shock going on at this point. But again, it's a military situation, and the men held their marks. After a prolonged period of time, Larry and Adrian, I expect other men next to them, saw a glow coming from the far side of the craft, which was not described to me in any way like anything I've ever seen popularized in fiction or reports that we've gotten of other, you know, alleged machines from places unknown. You could make out fittings and, you know, like bolts, but again, best observed diagonally, peripherally, rather than straight on. It had a reddish, very pronounced light at the top and tapered down to a bank of cobalt blue lights at the bottom. And they observed a glow coming from the far side, and the glow began to move. And it started to come around and then cleared the end of the craft to a point where the glow, they could now make it out more clearly without any obstruction. And as the glow sort of diminished, they could make out three distinct shapes within the glow. They were, for lack of a more descriptive word, beings. They were humanoid in appearance. They had, you know, torsos and arms and legs and heads, but they were not human. They were not the archetypical ubiquitous grays that everybody now knows and are part of popular culture, as well as form the bulk of most authentic reportings of, you know, non-human characters that we get in UFO sightings. And they were just there. They were about 4 feet tall. They were stocky. They had the often reported extremely large, proportionally deep black eyes. And if there was nose or mouth, you couldn't really make it out. They seemed to be in a one-piece kind of, you know, fitting garment. And just to make it, you know, if that's not enough, they were floating about a foot off the ground and slightly translucent. Again, the men held the ground. And there were no threats. If you remember back to one of my favorite, and certainly one of the great kings of the B-science fiction movies, The Day the Earth Stood Still, and still one of the best, there is that sequence where, you know, the UFO lands across the street from the Capitol building, and Michael Rennie, playing the alien, gets out, and as he's pulling out a device that he's going to present to the president, he's surrounded by troops aiming M1s at him, and somebody pulls a trigger, and he's shot. And it does make you think that if these men had been armed, maybe something would have happened that could have resulted in another level of problem. But they were not armed. And these beings just floated there. The men just stood their ground. And then about this point, as you mentioned, a more senior personnel, and we maintain and always have, that was then the base wing commander, Colonel Gordon Williams, in evening clothes coming from a party, stepped through the cordon of men, also unarmed, and he's a big guy, 6'2", 6'3", and stopped 10 or so feet from these beings and looked down at them, and they looked up at him. And communication is a word that is used, and I think because we don't know what else to say about this. When you look in someone's eyes, you're communicating. The fact is, standard psychological texts usually underscore the fact that 70 or so percent of all human communication is nonverbal, body language, eye contact, what have you. So in that sense, I guess there was communication, but there was no physical contact, there was no words, there was no exchange of things, and Colonel Williams, who interestingly has come forward now, fully retired as a two-star general some years ago, and I don't know whether he thinks this is funny, but he has made it very clear that he will neither confirm nor deny his involvement, where it would be very easy to just say, no, I wasn't there. He doesn't do that. And Larry and Adrian were ordered to go in for a closer look, and they got within a few feet of the thing and then backed up again. This went on into the wee hours of the morning, and at a certain point, a senior non-commissioned individual, that would have been Sergeant Ball, started to go round the circle slowly and tap out like every third guy, indicating that they should withdraw and head back to the staging area. And Larry was in, like, the second-to-last group to be tapped out. And when he got back to that point where the forest meets the field, he stopped and turned around again and fixed the whole thing in his mind, the craft, the beings, the remaining men, the officer. And then went back to the staging area up the road. The men were put back in vehicles. They were told not to discuss this with each other, with anyone. Some of them did. They were quieted. They were very shaken up. They did not feel good. Larry said he had a decidedly metallic taste in his mouth. His eyes felt dry and kind of clicked when he blinked. They're back, in the mess hall about dawn, and then go back to their billets, being told that they will be debriefed on this later. I can't imagine anybody sleeping. Larry certainly didn't. Later that morning, he went to call his mother to tell her about this, completely against orders, and he's the first to say that. He's particularly close to his mom, had a rather dramatic UFO incident with her several years before. Joanne Warren, who's a great woman, nobody you'd ever want to tangle with in terms of saying you're not telling the truth, I think she's terrific, was home in upstate New York when Larry called her. Larry had a witness with him, Greg Batcham, who is referred to in the book on a number of occasions and who has confirmed this. And Joanne had a witness, an old friend of hers who I've spoken to. And Larry called and essentially said words to the effect of, "Mom, you're never going to believe what happened last night. We had a UFO land and base and blah, blah, blah." And the next thing he knows, he's speaking to dead air.